From Genetic Engineering and Biotechnology News, this is the GenCast Network. Bringing you compelling and in-depth interviews with the biotech industry's leading researchers, newsmakers, and thought leaders. This week on the GenCast Network. Ben Conway from Johnston Blakely & Company and Isaac Rowe from Leerink Swan are interviewed by Gen's Editor-in-Chief John Sterling about Enlight Biosciences, the new drug discovery company recently founded by PureTech Ventures in collaboration with Eli Lilly, Pfizer, and Merck & Company.
Ben Conway is founder and managing director of Johnston Blakely & Company, a Boston-based investment bank focused on the life sciences industry. Isaac Rowe is a senior analyst covering the life science, tools, and medical devices sectors at Leerink Swan, a healthcare-focused investment banking firm in New York. On July 10th, PureTech Ventures, Merck, Pfizer, and Eli Lilly announced that they were joining forces to found a new firm, Enlight Biosciences. The company says it will work on the development of novel drug discovery technologies. Why is there a need for another drug discovery company? And what unique advantages might Enlight Biosciences bring to the table? Ben, let's begin with you.
Thanks, John. You know, I think really the need arises from the fact that investment in new discovery tools has really largely been abandoned since the beginning of this decade. At the beginning of the decade, we saw significant interest in the area, primarily related to such technologies as high-throughput screening and genomic discoveries. And we saw a significant number of IPOs come public based on those technologies and the promise of those technologies. But what's happened is that promise has really never been materialized. And so that today, we see the pendulum has swung completely the other way in the markets, and so it would appear that Enlight seems to be moving in to fill this void.
Isaac? Sure. I mean, I think one of the macro issues pressing on the entire drug industry is the fact that, you know, if you look back at the last probably 10 years, you know, the annual pace of new drug approvals has really hovered in the 20 to 30 area, and if anything, trended downward towards 20. In the meantime, R&D expenditures have really increased from, call it, $15 to $20 billion annually up to $40 or $45 billion. So, you know, you've seen a doubling in the investment made in drug development with really no yield on drug approval. So I do think there's a need to take another approach at developing drugs.
Now, Enlight officials say they will focus on pre-competitive technology that will connect preclinical research, clinical development, and medical practice. What might they mean by pre-competitive technology, Ben?
John, what we've seen is over the past 15 years or so, Big Pharma has really focused largely on developing a differentiated advantage further downstream in areas such as clinical and regulatory affairs and sales and marketing. Yeah, and it's largely been the biopharmaceutical companies that are the originators of innovation and new products. And so from this perspective, the pharma industry, in my opinion, doesn't really view these earlier discovery activities, especially the tools and technologies that facilitate the discoveries, as competitive. You know, in fact, if we look at the trends toward NDA approvals, when you look at strictly where those compounds originated, in 2004, and this trend has continued to date. You know, in 2004, though, for example, we see that of the 44 or 45 NDAs, seven originated from Big Pharma. And so that gives you an indication of where Big Pharma is really placing their competitive chips, I'll say.
Isaac, how do you view this pre-competitive technology angle?
Sure. I mean, there's a couple of different things I think all floating around this topic. First, obviously, is the changing regulatory environment, which I think Bob mentioned. And then also, you know, if you look at a lot of the work that's fallen out of the Human Genome Project in 2000 and 2001, you've got a whole new level of awareness from a genetic level as to where various disease states originate. And then, of course, you know, how they might be linked to each other. So I do think that there's a constructive effort that needs to be taken towards looking at the genetic data and applying it to, you know, large areas of clinical interest. And, you know, one of the examples that's pretty far down the road right now would be Alzheimer's disease. You've got companies like Elon and Wyeth, and then you've got smaller companies like Medivation all really tackling what is one of the last large untapped areas of disease. And so, you know, trying to find the next area that's readily accessible, that's something that I think they're talking about.
Looking at the highly competitive nature of the pharma business, and I've been doing that for 24 years, so I know how competitive that is, how unusual is it that three major drug firms, basically three rivals,
would collaborate on the creation of a new company. And what do you see as the major driver for their decision to form this collaboration, Ben?
John, it's funny you say that because on the surface it would look unusual. You know, save for the fact, though, that these activities don't appear to define, as we were just discussing, the core competitive advantage for the pharma industry. To some extent, what it seems to be is they're looking to seed the ground in hopes of accelerating technologies that will ultimately benefit them. You could also say that from a certain perspective that what they're looking to do is create a standardized set of these technologies and tools to accelerate what they're ultimately looking to get at, and that is robust compounds or clinical candidates that will ultimately translate into drugs and faster.
Isaac? Sure. I mean, I think if you look at all these companies, and this is sort of, not specific necessarily to the three companies involved in this project, but across the board, you've had a lot of pressure on top line driven by generics and the related things, and at the same time, an increasing spend, as I mentioned before, on R&D. And so if you look at the combined companies, you know, you're looking at about, I think, $14 billion in R&D spent last year between those three companies. And obviously, those are things that need to be reined in as the top-line growth slows down. So I think just another data point, the contract research organizations would tell you that preclinical outsourcing is likely to double over the next 5 years. So not only is there pressure on an absolute basis, but also on where that work is being done. So, you know, the companies would love to own, I think, these assets and develop these technologies themselves in-house as much as they can. I think they still view that as an important calling card to their franchises. And so to the extent that they can try and collaborate and create technologies and drug projects that are proprietary to them, they'll want to do that. So, you know, they're all looking at each other, facing the same issues, and I think trying to tackle them somewhat together.
So, Ben, we just talked about the three major drug firms that were involved. What was PureTech Ventures' interest in this deal?
That's an interesting question. You know, and PureTech isn't necessarily venture capital. It's more venture creation. So they'll create the entity and then seek the capital investment from the VCs. My question is, it's an interesting concept, and I don't know the absolute details behind the deal or its structure, but what is the exit for someone like a PureTech? If you're looking for an investment, I mean, I can see the benefit for the pharma companies, but for PureTech per se, you know, unless it comes from licensing fees or some downstream financial benefits, how does a PureTech monetize the investment? And again, I don't know whether it's PureTech organizing it and the pharma is contributing the funds, but still, there's got to be some kind of a payback. I don't know whether it's a management fee, but an interesting opportunity. I don't know if it's clear cut as to what the return will be. Isaac, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, right. This is clearly not a typical VC model where you fund early and look to get low-priced equity well before the product reaches market. I think that model has been tried many times in the form of the biotech industry. If you look at, you know, the vast majority of biotech companies that are publicly traded, almost none of them make any money, and they're perpetually burning cash several rounds post-IPO. So I think if you look at, the way to create value, I mean, a lot of times you're seeing recently, I think, a lot of interest in guys like Paul Capital and Royalty Capital, I think, guys that take different approaches to monetizing different assets through royalties or cross-licensing structured deals where it's not really necessarily directly in their hands, but they own a stake in the venture. So this is, again, I think, an alternative way of trying to capture some of the value in the new wave of drug development that we're kind of in front of here. So how it goes, I think, is still very much undefined today, but it definitely speaks to the fact that the traditional venture capital model for biotech is a very expensive way to try and get a shot on goal for a major drug. And, this is a way where they can maybe take a little bit less risk while still participating in some of the upside should something come out of this venture.
I'd agree with that.
When the news came out that Enlight Biosciences had been formed, the formal announcement said that the company, quote, would direct up to $39 million to advance breakthrough technologies that can fundamentally alter drug discovery and development. Now, $39 million to fundamentally alter drug discovery and development in an industry where it now takes over $1 billion and 10 years to come up with a new drug. Now, I'm very aware of the hype that often surrounds pharma news, but this statement seems to me, to put it mildly, highly ambitious. Am I missing something, Ben?
Clearly, this is an investment which is just to lay the foundation for what's hoped to be something more promising and give a foundation for what could be as far as new technologies and what have you. As I take it, this isn't strictly to develop new drugs per se. These are for tools that help facilitate the discovery of the new compounds. But even that said, there is significant investment to be made here. I think this is just the tip of the iceberg. It's got to be a considerable amount more to really ramp up the technologies, whatever they may be, to really do justice to them.
Isaac, what can you add to this $39 million investment?
Yeah, I mean, it seems like a small number for the promises they're hoping to deliver. And, you know, in an industry where our promises like that get made every day, it does seem a little bit of folly in my mind to ascribe that kind of a number and suggest that it can have that transformative an effect. I mean, I think, you know, another way to look at it would be just with informatics companies over the past decade or so trying to make a go of it. A lot of those companies have come and gone with a lot of fanfare and really very little translational work being done. And I think it, to me, speaks to the steepness of the curve, not only in terms of creating or changing the drug development process, but also the fact that a lot of this value really is tied up intrinsically within the drug companies that develop them individually. So your previous question about, you know, why would you see three typical competitors all jump into bed together, to me it speaks more largely to the sort of cost pressures that they face in their R&D work. And really, secondarily, would be the idea that you could actually create something with $39 million that would fundamentally change the industry. So I'm a bit of a skeptic here, and you know, no one's going to accuse me of being a visionary for taking that stance. But I do think that it seems like a much taller order than $40 million can address.
I definitely would agree, John. Let me just add something else. You know, there is obviously an enthusiasm and a belief that there's got to be a better way. I mean, if you look back to 2000 and the IPO class that came out then, it was only 37-38% of the entire set of IPOs that even had one compound in the clinic. That's changed significantly. 2004, it had shifted to 92% had a compound in the clinic. From 2005 through last year, in fact, 100% of the companies that came public all had clinical candidates. So, but again, if we reflect on the promise, or what's perceived to be the promise of accelerating the course of drug discovery and development, if you look back to 2000 and the IPO class then, I think that gives an indication of just what the enthusiasm would be, and I think this plays to that in part.
This sort of leads into my last question, Ben, because as you just mentioned, most life science investing over the past few years have been directed to late-stage programs. The Enlight Biosciences story seems to be a break from this model. Do you think that this could be the start of a new trend, especially with these three big major pharma companies involved, a trend where money will now start flowing into early stage drug discovery development? Ben?
Well, I hate to waffle, but it seems like it depends. Because on the one hand, it would seem that over the course of the past decade, investors more and more and more are recognizing the fact that to participate earlier, there's high uncertainty whether the return on investment, if there's even a return, is going to be reasonable. And so that's given rise to the fact that more and more the public markets and the venture communities by extension, they are investing later and later stage only to mitigate that early stage risk. In addition, we've seen that the investments in these tool companies in the early part of the decade, they haven't amounted to anything. But what we do see, though, and especially I think this would be the case in the situation where you don't have the exit opportunity through the public markets, when you look more toward big pharma through an acquisition as your exit, we do see that the interest, the M&A interest in big pharma has really been largely in these types of opportunities. I mean, obviously there have been very visible deals out there, such as the MedImmune deal for some $16 billion, and product-oriented deals. But over the past two and a half years, most of the M&A activity, I'll say anywhere from two-thirds to three-quarters, have been, this is the M&A activity for large pharma, I'll qualify that. But the activity, the M&A interest has been toward these earlier stage companies. You look at, GSK's acquisition of Searches. You look at Wyeth's acquisition of Haptogen. You can even say BMS's acquisition of AdNexus. Again, over the past number of years, there has been clearly an interest in big pharma in these earlier stage companies. So that's where I would come out on that.
Isaac?
Yeah, and I would agree with Ben. I do think that the largest drug company have generally taken a buy versus build approach to fueling their early stage pipelines. You know, as it relates to the companies that I follow, the arms dealers to the drug industry, the spending has definitely been very tempered for what you would call legacy technologies, things like HPLC, mass spectrometry. Those types of instrumentation products have really had what I would call mid to high single-digit growth rates, and a lot of that growth has been fueled by growth in international markets and in emerging geographies, things like that, and industrial customers for that matter. So that being said, there are, I think, dollars set aside for really translational technologies. A best example of that would be this company, Illumina, which has grown revenues from about $28 million in 2003 to exceed $500 million this year in 2008. So five-year period, you know, you're seeing a massive, you know, 20 times or whatever it is increase in revs because the technology really has had transformative powers on not only early-stage academic work but also early drug development processes where you're really looking for genetic underpinnings to disease states. So, you know, there is money, I think, out there for new technologies. In fact, companies are thirsty for it. But there really hasn't been, you know, for every one Illumina, there's 5 or 10 companies still making mass spectrometry. So I do think that truly transformative technology is hard to find. When it is out there, people are willing to spend on it. And that, to me, speaks to the interest that these companies would have should there be, you know, a really new way or transformative way of developing drugs.
So before we close this interview, I want to ask each of you any final thoughts, something we might not have touched on or covered with the questions regarding Enlight Biosciences and the involvement of these three major pharma firms. Ben?
We've covered the higher level issues, you know, quite nicely. I do wonder what the exit strategy, how do you monetize? If you're an investor, say, albeit a, you know, strategic investor, understand that perspective. But if you're a financial investor, you know, how do you monetize this most efficiently?
I agree. I think the idea is very interesting. I think the interest is there. I think the economic part of the equation becomes very muddy. You know, 5-7 years out, as this process eventually yields some kind of results or some kind of a product worth pursuing. It does create issues there that, you know, I'm sure will be addressed, but today seem relatively unclear. And for that reason, I think you see relatively little in the initial press release and initial presentation on the website regarding how the economic side would work. I think that's something that, you know, you'd love to have that problem. You'd love to be at that point where this is actually yielding something and then have an actual problem figuring out where all the money goes.
Right.
I'm John Sterling. Thanks for listening. If you would like to comment on this week's podcast, please go to our podcast section at www.genengnews.com and give us your thoughts. We'd really like to hear from you. Bye for now.
To learn more about topics discussed in this GenCast or to listen to previous GenCasts, visit our website at www.genengnews.com. New GenCasts are posted every week, Thursday, 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. For the Gen Publishing editorial staff, I'm Jonathan Ellinghouse saying thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in again next week to the GenCast Network.